fully-fledged alliance on terms that Berlin could reasonably be expected to accept. In 1901, for example, with British forces tied down in South Africa and the Russians piling on the pressure in China, Foreign Secretary Lansdowne was so keen to secure German support against Russia that he circulated to Cabinet a draft proposal for a secret treaty of alliance with Germany that would, under certain conditions, have committed Britain and Germany to wage war on Russia in support of Japan. Tentative feelers were put out to Berlin, but the Germans were reluctant to be drawn into any kind of anti-Russian combination, for fear that this would leave them perilously exposed in a continental conflict in which the support of the British Navy would carry little weight. The question that worried Bülow was, what could the British offer the Germans that would offset the heightened French and Russian enmity that a German alliance with Britain would inevitably bring in its wake? This was the structural problem that always haunted efforts to formalize an Anglo-German rapprochement. A further and more obvious problem was that Berlin's efforts to pursue German interests outside Europe inevitably met with protest from Britain. When the Turkish Sultan Abdul Hamid entrusted the Deutsche Bahn Gesellschaft with the construction of a branch line of the Anatolian Railway to Konya in the direction of Baghdad, there were loud complaints from the British government, which saw in the German-financed project an unauthorized penetration into the English sphere, because it would diminish the profitability of the British-financed Smyrna Railway. In this, as in many other disputes, British policymakers proceeded from the assumption that whereas British imperial interests were vital and essential, German ones were a mere luxury, the energetic pursuit of which must be construed as a provocation by other powers. The dispute over the Anglo-Congolese Treaty of the 12th of May, 1894, by which Britain acquired a 25-kilometer-wide corridor of land linking Uganda with Rhodesia, was a further case in point. This treaty, essentially designed to obstruct French designs on the Upper Nile, also had the effect of abutting German Southeast Africa with a cordon of British territory. Only under concerted German pressure did London eventually back down. This outcome produced jubilation in a German press desperate for signs of national self-assertion. It also reinforced the belief among German policymakers that standing up to Britain was the only way to secure German interests. Anglo-German tension peaked during the Transvaal crisis of 1894-5. There had long been local problems between the British-controlled Cape Colony and the neighbouring Boer South African Republic, also known as the Transvaal. Although the independence of the Transvaal was internationally recognised, including by Britain, Cecil Rhodes, the dominant figure in the Cape Colony, pressed for annexation of the northern neighbour, lured by the vast gold deposits discovered there in the 1880s. Since German settlers played a prominent role in the Transvaal economy, and Germans owned one-fifth of all foreign capital invested there, the Berlin government took an interest in maintaining the Republic's independence. In 1894, Berlin's involvement in plans to build a German-financed railway linking the landlocked Transvaal with Delagoa Bay in Portuguese Mozambique triggered protests from London. While the British government considered acquiring control of the offending railway through the annexation of Delagoa Bay and rejected any arrangement that would dilute their political and economic dominance in the region, the Germans insisted on the continuing political and economic independence of the Transvaal. There was further friction in the autumn of 1895 when the British ambassador in Berlin, Sir Edward Mallet, spoke of the Transvaal as a trouble spot in Anglo-German relations and hinted darkly at the possibility of war between the two countries if Germany refused to back down. The German government were thus in an ill humour when an abortive British attack on the Transvaal in December 1895 triggered an international crisis. The British government had not formally sanctioned Dr. Leander Starr Jameson's raid on the Republic, though at least one British government minister, Joseph Chamberlain, had prior knowledge of it. And the raid itself was a fiasco. Jameson's men were quickly defeated and captured by troops of the Transvaal Republic. In Berlin, as in Paris and St. Petersburg, it was universally believed, despite official denials from Whitehall, that London was behind the attempted invasion. Determined to signal its indignation, the German government dispatched a personal telegram from the Kaiser to Paul Kruger, President of the Transvaal Republic. The Kruger telegram, as it came to be known, wished the President a Happy New Year and congratulated him on having defended the independence of his country against external attack without appealing for the help of friendly powers. This mildly worded message produced a torrent of outrage in the British press and a corresponding wave of jubilation in Germany, where it was welcomed as a sign that something was finally being done to stand up for German interests overseas. But the Kruger telegram was little more than gesture politics. Germany quickly withdrew from the confrontation with Great Britain over Southern Africa. It lacked the means to project its will, or even to secure the respect due to an equal partner in such conflicts of interest. Berlin ultimately accepted a compromise agreement, which in return for nugatory British concessions, excluded Germany from further involvement in the political future of Southern Africa. To the disgust of the German nationalist press, the German government refused to intervene on behalf of the Transvaal before or during the Boer War of 1899-1902 that resulted in the Transvaal's defeat and its conversion into a British colony. The 1890s were thus a period of deepening German isolation. A commitment from Britain remained elusive, and the Franco-Russian alliance seemed to narrow considerably the room for movement on the continent. Yet Germany's statesmen were extraordinarily slow to see the scale of the problem, mainly because they believed that the continuing tension between the world empires was in itself a guarantee that these would never combine against Germany. Far from countering their isolation through a policy of rapprochement, German policymakers raised the quest for self-reliance to the status of a guiding principle. The most consequential manifestation of this development was the decision to build a large navy. In the mid-1890s, after a long period of stagnation and relative decline, naval construction and strategy came to occupy a central place in German security and foreign policy. Public opinion played a role here. In Germany, as in Britain, big ships were the fetish of the quality press and its educated middle-class readers. The immensely fashionable navalism of the American writer Alfred Thayer Mahon also played a part. Mahon foretold in The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, 1890, a struggle for global power that would be decided by vast fleets of heavy battleships and cruisers. Kaiser Wilhelm II, who supported the naval program, was a keen nautical hobbyist and an avid reader of Mahon. In the sketchbooks of the young Wilhelm, we find many battleships, lovingly penciled floating fortresses bristling with enormous guns. But the international dimension was also crucial. It was, above all, the sequence of peripheral clashes with Britain that triggered the decision to acquire a more formidable naval weapon. After the Transvaal episode, the Kaiser became obsessed with the need for ships, to the point where he began to see virtually every international crisis as a lesson in the primacy of naval power. The Kaiser's deepening personal preoccupation with naval matters coincided with a bitter factional struggle within the uppermost ranks of the German naval administration. The chief of the naval cabinet, Admiral Baron Gustav von Senden-Biebrann, and his ambitious protégé, Alfred von Tirpitz, pressed for the construction on a grand scale of large battleships. On the other side of the fight was the cautious Admiral Friedrich Hollmann, Secretary of State for the Navy and the man with responsibility for drafting naval bills for the Reichstag. Hollmann remained committed to the construction of a force of fast cruisers of the type favoured by the still-fashionable French Jeune École. Whereas Tirpitz saw German naval strategy in terms of a future struggle for parity with Great Britain in waters close to home, Hollmann envisaged a more flexible long-distance weapon that would be used to press German claims and protect German interests on the periphery. Between 1893 and 1896, Tirpitz and his allies waged a guerrilla campaign against Hollmann, openly questioning his competence and bombarding the Kaiser with memoranda outlining their own strategy proposals. After oscillating for a while between the two camps, Wilhelm II withdrew his support from Hollmann in 1897 and appointed Tirpitz in his place. On the 26th of March, 1898, following an intense propaganda campaign, the Reichstag passed a new navy bill. In place of the eclectic and unfocused proposals of the early and mid-1890s, Admiral von Tirpitz's Imperial Naval Office instilled a massive long-term construction program that would dominate German defense expenditure until 1912. Its ultimate objective was to enable Germany to confront the British Navy on equal terms. Germany's decision to embark on an ambitious naval program has occupied a commanding position in the literature on the origins of the First World War. Viewed with hindsight, it might appear to foreshadow, or even perhaps to explain, the conflict that broke out in 1914. Wasn't the decision to challenge British naval hegemony a needless provocation that permanently soured relations between the two states and deepened the polarization of the European system? There are many criticisms one can make of German naval strategy, the most serious being that it was not embedded in a broader policy concept, beyond the quest for a free hand in world affairs. But the new naval program was neither an outrageous nor an unwarranted move. The Germans had ample reason to believe that they would not be taken seriously unless they acquired a credible naval weapon. It should not be forgotten that the British were accustomed to using a rather masterful tone in their communications with the Germans. In March 1897, for example, a meeting took place between the Assistant Under-Secretary at the British Foreign Office, Sir Francis Bertie, known as the Bull for his aggressive manner, and the Chargé d'Affaires and acting German ambassador in London, Baron Hermann von Eckardstein. In the course of their discussion, Eckardstein, a notorious Anglophile who dressed in the manner of Edward VII and loved to be seen about the London clubs, touched on the question of German interests in southern Africa. Bertie's response came as a shock. "Should the Germans lay so much as a finger on the Transvaal," Bertie declared, "the British government would not stop at any step, even the ultimate," an unmistakable reference to war, "to repel any German intervention. Should it come to a war with Germany," he went on, "this entire English nation would be behind it, and a blockade of Hamburg and Bremen and the annihilation of German commerce on the high seas would be child's play for the English fleet." German naval policy has to be seen against this background of friction and threat. Of course, there can be no doubt about the anti-English orientation of the new weapon. Tirpitz himself made this abundantly clear. The memorandum setting out his fleet plan to the Kaiser in June 1897 began with the lapidary observation that, "For Germany, the most dangerous naval enemy at the present time is England." And the same assertion cropped up in various forms throughout the draft proposals and memoranda of later years. But there was nothing surprising about this. Armaments programs usually measure themselves against the most formidable potential opponent. Until the signing of the Entente Cordiale in 1904, the programmatic documents of the French naval strategists of the Jeune École had envisioned the systematic use, in the event of war, of fast, well-armed cruisers to attack commercial shipping and force the British Isles into starvation and submission. As late as 1898, this prospect had seemed real enough in British naval circles to generate panic over the need for extra cruisers and the consolidation of domestic food supplies. In any case, it was not the building of German ships after 1898 that propelled Britain into closer relations with France and Russia. The decisions to enter into an entente with France and to seek an arrangement with Russia came about primarily as a consequence of pressures on the imperial periphery. British policymakers were less obsessed with and less alarmed by German naval building than is often supposed. British naval strategy was never focused solely on Germany, but on the need to remain dominant in a world of great naval powers, including France, Russia, and the United States. Nor did German naval construction have the mesmerizing effect on British strategists that has sometimes been claimed for it. In 1905, the director of British naval intelligence could confidently describe Britain's naval preponderance over Germany as overwhelming. In October 1906, Charles Harding, permanent Under-Secretary at the Foreign Office, acknowledged that Germany posed no immediate naval threat to Britain. In the following year, Admiral Sir A.K. Wilson remarked in a report on current Admiralty war plans that an Anglo-German conflict was unlikely, that neither power was in a position to do the other any vital injury, and that it was difficult to see how such a conflict could arise. Foreign Secretary Edward Grey was also sanguine. "We shall have 7 dreadnoughts afloat before they have one," he observed in November 1907. "In 1910 they will have 4 to our 7, but between now and then there is plenty of time to lay down new ones if they do so." Even the first Sea Lord, Sir John Jacky Fisher, wrote to King Edward VII in 1907, boasting of Britain's superiority over the Germans. "England has 7 dreadnoughts and 3 invincibles, while Germany has not yet begun one." There was good reason for such confidence, because the Germans lost the naval race hands down. Whereas the number of German battleships rose from 13 to 16 in the years 1898 to 1905, the British battle fleet rose from 29 to 44 ships. Tirpitz had aimed at achieving a ratio of 1 German battleship to every 1.5 British, but he never got close. In 1913, the German naval command formally and unilaterally renounced the Anglo-German arms race, Tirpitz declaring that he was satisfied with the ratio's demanded Britain. By 1914, Britain's lead was once again increasing. The naval scares that periodically swept through the British press and political circles were real enough, but they were driven in large part by campaigns launched by the navalists to fend off demands for funding from the cash-starved British Army. There was thus a gross discrepancy between the rhetorical storm kicked up by Tirpitz and his colleagues to justify naval expenditure, and the relatively meagre results achieved. German naval construction was intended to provide support for what had come to be known by 1900 as Weltpolitik, meaning literally global policy. The term denoted a foreign policy based on extending Germany's influence as a global power, and thereby aligning it with the other big players on the world scene. Phenomenal masses of land will be partitioned in all corners of the world in the course of the next decades, the historian and publicist Hans Delbruck warned in an important essay of 1897. And the nationality that remains empty-handed will be excluded for a generation to come from the ranks of those great peoples that define the contours of the human spirit. In a popular and influential speech of the 6th of December, 1897, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Bernhard von Bülow, articulated the ebullient new mood. "The times when the German left the earth to one of his neighbors, the sea to the other, and reserved for himself the heavens where pure philosophy reigns, these times are over," he announced. "We don't want to put anyone in the shadow, but we too demand our place in the sun." For a time, the word Weltpolitik seemed to capture the mood of the German middle classes and the national-minded quality press. The word resonated because it bundled together so many contemporary aspirations. Weltpolitik meant the quest to expand foreign export markets at a time of declining export growth. It meant escaping from the constraints of the Continental Alliance system to operate on a broader world arena. It expressed the appetite for genuinely national projects that would help knit together the disparate regions of the German Empire, and reflected the almost universal conviction that Germany, a late arrival at the imperial feast, would have to play catch-up if it wished to earn the respect of the other great powers. Yet, while it connoted all these things, Weltpolitik never acquired a stable or precise meaning. Even Bernhard von Bülow, widely credited with establishing Weltpolitik as the guiding principle of German foreign policy, never produced a definitive account of what it was. His contradictory utterances on the subject suggest that it was little more than the old policy of the free hand with a larger navy and more menacing mood music. "We are supposed to be pursuing Weltpolitik," the former chief of the General Staff, General Alfred von Waldersee, noted grumpily in his diary in January 1900. "If only I knew what that was supposed to be." The concrete achievements of Weltpolitik after 1897 were correspondingly modest, especially if we measure them against the imperial predations of the United States in the same years. While Germany secured the Mariana and Caroline Islands, a segment of Samoa and the small bridgehead at Keychau on the Chinese coast, the United States waged war against Spain over Cuba and in the process acquired the Philippines, Puerto Rico, and Guam in 1898, formalized its possession of Hawaii in the same year, fought a horrific colonial war in the Philippines, 1899-1902, that cost between 500,000 and 750,000 Filipino lives, acquired some of the Samoan Islands in 1899, and subsequently built a canal across the Central American Isthmus under the protection of a canal zone under its own control, in accordance with its Secretary of State's express view that it was practically sovereign on the continent of South America. When Bülow wrote to Kaiser Wilhelm II in exultant tones that "this gain will stimulate people and navy to follow your majesty further along the path which leads to world power, greatness, and eternal glory," he was referring to Germany's acquisition of the economically and strategically worthless Caroline Islands. Small wonder that some historians have concluded that Germany's Weltpolitik was designed above all with domestic consumers in mind, as a means of strengthening national solidarity, saddling the national parliament with long-term budgetary commitments, muting the appeal of dissident political creeds such as social democracy, and thereby consolidating the dominance of the existing industrial and political elites. Perhaps the most remarkable shortcoming of German policy in the years around 1900 was the failure to see how swiftly the international environment was changing to Germany's disadvantage. The policymakers in Berlin remained confident in the first years of the 20th century that the global tension between the British Empire and Russia would continue to guarantee a certain freedom of maneuver for Germany. In the short term, they focused on maintaining good relations with St. Petersburg. In the longer run, they believed, the burden of opposing Russia and the growth of the German fleet would force Britain to seek better relations with Berlin. The Great Turning Point. On the night of the 8th to 9th of February 1904, Admiral Togo Heiachiro's fleet attacked and sank Russian battleships at anchor off Port Arthur on the Chinese coast, thereby starting the Russo-Japanese War. The Japanese began the conflict, but it was the Russians who had provoked it. For the past decade, the Tsar and his most powerful advisers had been mesmerized by the prospect of acquiring a vast East Asian empire. The Russians had steadily pushed forward into northern China, the Liaodong Peninsula, and northern Korea, encroaching on the Japanese sphere of interest. They used the Boxer Rebellion of 1898-1901, itself in part the consequence of Russian incursions into China, as a pretext for sending 177,000 troops to Manchuria, supposedly to protect its railways. After the rebellion subsided, Russia ignored demands from the other powers for the withdrawal of its troops. By early 1903, it was clear that they intended to occupy Manchuria indefinitely. Repeated requests from the Japanese for a formal demarcation of Russian and Japanese spheres of influence in Manchuria and Korea respectively received short shrift in St. Petersburg. Strengthened by their alliance in 1902 with Britain, the Japanese felt confident enough to take matters into their own hands. The war that followed brought defeat for Russia on a scale that no one had foreseen. Two of the three Russian fleets were destroyed. The third, the Black Sea Fleet, was saved, ironically enough, by the restrictions still preventing Russian warships from passing the Turkish Straits. Russian forces were overrun and defeated in Manchuria in 1904. The Japanese besieged Port Arthur, and the army sent to relieve it was forced to retreat from the area. In January 1905, after a long and bitter fight, Port Arthur surrendered. 2 months later, a Japanese army numbering 270,000 men routed a slightly larger Russian force near Mukden in Manchuria. While these disasters were unfolding, a wave of inter-ethnic violence, massive strikes, political protests, and uprisings swept across the Russian Empire, exposing the inner fragility of the Tsarist autocracy. At one point, an army of nearly 300,000, larger than the force facing the Japanese in Manchuria, had to be stationed in Poland to restore order. The impact of the Russo-Japanese conflict was both profound and ambivalent. In the short term, the war seemed to offer Germany unexpected opportunities to break through the constraints imposed by the Franco-Russian alliance and the Anglo-French Entente. In the longer term, however, it had precisely the opposite effect. It produced a tightening of the alliance system that refocused formerly peripheral tensions onto the continent of Europe and drastically reduced Germany's freedom of movement. Since both these aspects bear on the events of 1914, it is worth looking briefly at each in turn. By the summer of 1904, Germany's diplomatic position was substantially worse than it had been when Bismarck left office in 1890. German political leaders made light of these developments, mainly because they believed that tensions between Britain and the Continental Powers would keep the door to a German-British rapprochement permanently open. Against this background, the news of the Anglo-French Entente came as a serious blow. In a letter to Bülow of April 1904, Kaiser Wilhelm informed the Chancellor that the Entente gave him much food for thought, because the fact that England and France no longer had to fear anything from each other meant that their need to take account of our position becomes ever less pressing. How could Germany extricate itself from this unhappy state of affairs? Two options presented themselves. The first was to commit the Reich to an arrangement with Russia, and thereby weaken or neutralize the Franco-Russian alliance. The second was to find some means of weakening the new Entente between Britain and France. The Russo-Japanese War provided the opportunity to test both options. The German Kaiser had been calling for some time, without success, for a diplomatic approach to the Russians, and he quickly spotted the advantages to be reaped from Russia's predicament. In a letter of February 1904 to the Tsar, he pointed out that the French were supplying the Japanese with raw materials, and thus hardly behaving as reliable allies. In June, he told Nicholas that he believed France's entente with Britain, an ally of Japan, was preventing the French from coming to your aid. Other letters made sympathetic noises about the ill fortune of the Russian army and expressed confidence in future successes. The Germans also provided more practical help, such as the coaling of Russian battleships from German stations en route to the east. These overtures culminated in two formal offers of alliance. The first, presented on the 30th of October 1904, proposed an alliance stipulating that each of the two signatories would come to the other's aid in the event of either being attacked in Europe or anywhere else in the world. But Tsar Nicholas was unwilling to enter into a formal agreement before consulting his French ally. Since it was inconceivable that the French would agree, this was tantamount to rejecting the proposal. By the summer of 1905, however, Russia's domestic and military position had worsened drastically. When the Kaiser renewed his approaches to Nicholas, he found the Tsar more inclined to consider a German offer. In the summer of 1905, the royal yacht Hohenzollern made its way towards the small fishing village of Bjurko in the Gulf of Finland for a rendezvous with the Tsar's Polar Star. The two boats moored alongside each other on the 23rd of July, and the Tsar came aboard for dinner. Confidential discussions followed, during which Wilhelm played, with considerable success, on the Tsar's anxieties about British designs against Russia and the unreliability of the French, who had now thrown in their lot with Britain. The overwrought Nicholas burst into tears, embraced his German cousin, and signed on the dotted line. But the draft treaty that resulted did not survive the scrutiny of the Tsar's officials in St. Petersburg. It was impossible, they pointed out, to reconcile a commitment to Berlin with the French alliance that still constituted the bedrock of Russian security. Reports from Paris confirmed that the French would never tolerate any alteration of the terms of the alliance for the sake of Russo-German rapprochement. The Tsar remained favorably disposed to an agreement of some kind with Germany, but under pressure from his political and economic advisers, he gradually dropped the idea. The eastern road out of German isolation was thus closed off, at least for the foreseeable future. At the same time, the German leadership looked for ways of pushing open the door that had recently been shut by the Anglo-French Entente. As part of the comprehensive settlement of outstanding colonial disputes, negotiated through the Entente Cordiale, the British had agreed to recognize Morocco as standing within the French sphere of influence, in return for French recognition of British primacy in Egypt. Determined to capitalize on this arrangement while the British commitment was still fresh, the French government sent a diplomatic mission to Fez with a view to arranging the consolidation of French control in Morocco in January 1905. Given the terms of the Anglo-French agreement, there was nothing especially surprising in the bid to consolidate French power in Morocco. But the French foreign minister chose to endow the policy with a pointedly anti-German spin. Potential disagreements with Spain had been resolved through the exchange of territory, and the North African agreement of 1902 with Italy ensured that Rome would be acquiescent. British agreement was built into the terms of the Entente. But the Germans were offered nothing. Berlin was not even informed in advance of French intentions. This was a departure from Delcasse's own earlier policy, which had foreseen that German assent would be negotiated in return for territorial compensation in other parts of Africa where she may have ambitions. In opting to freeze the Germans out, Delcasse built an entirely unnecessary element of provocation into his North African policy and exposed himself to the criticism of his French colleagues. Even Paul Revoil, Delcasse's closest collaborator in the Moroccan question, lamented the minister's intransigence. The great misfortune, Revoil protested, was that Delcasse found it repugnant to have talks with Germany. "The Germans are swindlers," he says. "But in heaven's name, I'm not asking for an exchange of romantic words or lovers' rings, but for a business discussion." Even Eugène Étienne, leader of the French colonial party, viewed Delcasse's refusal to negotiate with the Germans over Morocco as the height of imprudence. The German Foreign Office, for its part, had long been watching French moves in Morocco with suspicion, and was determined not to allow the French government to act unilaterally in a manner that would damage German interests in the area. The German viewpoint was legitimate in legal terms. An international agreement of 1881 had formally recognized Morocco as an area whose status could only be altered multilaterally by international treaty. The ultimate objective of German policy, however, was not to uphold international law, but rather to test the strength of the Entente. Reports from London had given the Germans reason to suppose that the British government would not feel bound to intervene in a dispute over Morocco between France and a third power. It was hoped that this in turn would remind the French, in the Kaiser's quaint formulation, that a navy has no wheels, and thereby soften their opposition to an understanding of some kind with Germany. In this sense, the Moroccan initiative can be seen as a Western version of the approaches made to Russia during 1904-5. Early in January 1905, a French delegation travelled to Fez in the Moroccan interior to demand control over the Moroccan army and police. The Sultan refused. On the 31st of March 1905, Kaiser Wilhelm II made a surprise visit to the city of Tangier. Amid delirious cheers from the population of the city, who saw in the German sovereign a welcome counterweight to the French, Wilhelm rode to the German legation, gave the cold shoulder to the third secretary of the French legation, who had welcomed him to Morocco in the name of Monsieur Delcasse, and made a speech in which he asserted that German commercial and economic interests, together with the independence and integrity of Morocco, should be maintained. After scarcely 2 hours in the city, he returned to his ship and sailed off. In the short term, this spectacular exercise in gesture politics was a great success. The landing prompted outrage in France, but the British showed no interest in intervening, and after a phase of mutual threats and brinkmanship, the French government opted to pursue a peaceful resolution. Théophile Delcasse was dismissed, and his policy of provocation temporarily discredited. His responsibilities were assumed by the new and inexperienced French premier, Maurice Rouvier, who proposed bilateral negotiations over the future of Morocco. But the Germans, unwisely in retrospect, tried to press their advantage, turning down Rouvier's proposal and insisting instead that the dispute be resolved at an international conference as required under the terms of the Treaty of 1881. The request was eventually granted, but the German triumph was short-lived. At the conference that convened in the Spanish port town of Algeciras in January 1906, the quasi-independence of Morocco was confirmed in general terms, but the German negotiators failed to gain any support from the other great powers, except for the Austrians, for their further proposals regarding the internationalization of the Moroccan police and financial institutions. Britain, Italy, and Spain, who had all been bought off through compensation deals, and Russia, which had been promised a further French loan in return for its support, sided firmly with France. The Russian delegates travelled to Algeciras with instructions to support energetically every French proposal. The uselessness of the Triple Alliance was revealed for all to see. It was, it turned out, a gross error to seek the multilateral resolution of an issue that had already been resolved by France bilaterally with most of the interested powers. The German policymakers had bungled. On the 5th of April 1906, Chancellor Bernhard von Bülow, chief architect of the German policy on Morocco, turned white and collapsed in the Reichstag, shortly after making a speech on the outcome of Algeciras. He was to remain in convalescence until October. The efforts of the German government to probe Eastern and Western options as a means of overcoming German isolation were thus a resounding failure. The Anglo-French Entente was strengthened rather than weakened by the German challenge to France in Morocco. In the East, too, the opportunities created for Germany by the Russo-Japanese War turned out to be illusory. The Eastern option was shut off for the foreseeable future in the summer of 1907, when Britain and Russia signed a treaty resolving all their disputes over Persia, Afghanistan, and Tibet. The Convention of 1907 was not driven by hostility towards or fear of Germany. It was rather the other way around. Since Russia posed the greater threat to Britain across a greater range of vulnerable points, it was Russia that must be appeased, and Germany that must be opposed. This had been the dominant British thinking on a rapprochement with Russia since before the turn of the century, and it remained valid after the convention was signed. In March 1909, Sir Charles Harding put the matter succinctly. "We have no pending questions with Germany except that of naval construction," he told Sir Arthur Nicholson, who would soon succeed him, "while our whole future in Asia is bound up with maintaining the best and most friendly relations with Russia. We cannot afford to sacrifice in any way our entente with Russia, even for the sake of a reduced naval program." The same point can be made for the Russian decision-makers who agreed the convention. This was not, for them, a policy directed against Germany, but rather a retrenching move designed to secure breathing space for domestic consolidation or, depending on whom you asked, greater freedom of external action. Of particular interest was the link between a deal over Persia and the prospect of British support for improved Russian access to the Turkish Straits. For Izvolsky and his ambassador in London, Count Benkendorf, the Straits question was the core of the convention, and the key to securing favorable revision of Russian access rights at a suitable time in the near future. In other words, while the new international system that emerged from 1907 chiefly disadvantaged Germany, we should not assume that this outcome faithfully reflected the designs that brought it about. Only in the case of France can one speak of a policy that consistently assigned a high priority to containing Germany. It makes more sense to think of this array of agreements as the European consequence of world historical transitions: the Sino-Japanese War and the emergence of Japan as a regional power, the fiscal burdens imposed by African conflict, and the Great Game in Central Asia, the retreat of Ottoman power in Africa and southwestern Europe, and the rise of the China question, meaning not just the great power competition there, but also the high levels of Chinese domestic turbulence that resulted. Germany's restlessness and its parvenu importuning were part of the picture, but they were perceived within a field of vision that encompassed broader concerns. The once widely held view that Germany caused its own isolation through its egregious international behavior is not borne out by a broader analysis of the processes by which the realignments of this era were brought about. In fact, the causal relationship between antagonism to Germany and the new alliance system ran to some extent in the other direction. It was not that antagonism to Germany caused its isolation, but rather that the new system itself channeled and intensified hostility towards the German Empire. In Russia's case, for example, the victory of Japan in the East and the provisional settlement of the imperial quarrel with Britain in Central Asia inevitably refocused foreign policy on the sole remaining theatre in which it could still pursue an imperial vision, the Balkans, an area where conflict with Austria-Hungary and, by extension, Germany, was going to be difficult to avoid. The old factional divide within the Russian foreign policy community between Asianists and Europeanists was resolved in the latter's favour. Under Izvolsky and Sozonov, Europeanists, who tended to distrust Germany and to favour good relations with Britain and France, always occupied a majority of the key positions. The Anglo-French Entente likewise neutralized the anti-British sentiment that before 1904 had intermittently diluted the Germanophobia of French statesmen. Painting the devil on the wall. Particularly striking is the case of Britain. It is astonishing how aggressively a number of key British policymakers responded to the German challenge to French penetration of Morocco. On the 22nd of April 1905, Foreign Secretary Lord Lansdowne informed the English ambassador in Paris that he believed the Germans might seek a port on the West African coast in compensation for the French seizure of Morocco, and that England was prepared to join with France in offering strong opposition to this proposal. The British ambassador in Paris was none other than Sir Francis the Bull Bertie, Viscount of Thame, the former parliamentary undersecretary who had browbeaten the German chargé d'affaires Eckartstein with threats of war over the Transvaal. In passing Lansdowne's message of support to Delcasse, who had heard nothing of German designs on a Moorish port, Bertie used much firmer language, conveying the sense of a categorical and unconditional support for French measures. The government of His Britannic Majesty, the French Foreign Office was told, considers that the conduct of Germany in the Moroccan question is most unreasonable in view of the attitude of Monsieur Delcasse, and it desires to accord to His Excellency all the support in its power. In a private conversation with Delcasse, Bertie stiffened the foreign minister's back with belligerent talk. A day or so later, the foreign minister informed a close associate that France's position was now impregnable, using language that recalled Bertie's earlier threats to Eckartstein. Germany knows that she would have England against her. I repeat that England would back us to the hilt and not sign peace without us. Do you think that the Emperor Wilhelm can calmly envisage the prospect of seeing his battle fleet destroyed, his naval commerce ruined, and his ports bombarded by the English fleet? There were militant signals from other parts of the British decision-making establishment as well. General Grierson, Director of Military Operations, accompanied by his deputy, made a personal inspection tour of the Franco-Belgian borderlands in March 1905 in order to appraise conditions for the landing of a British expeditionary force. In April, the First Sea Lord, Sir John Jacky Fisher, who had been longing to have a go at the Germans since the beginning of the crisis, went so far as to propose that the British Navy deploy to the Kiel Canal and land an expeditionary force on the coast of Schleswig-Holstein. These strikingly belligerent responses had nothing to do with the rights or wrongs of the position adopted by Germany vis-à-vis the French penetration of Morocco. They resulted from the apprehension that Germany was testing the strength of the new Entente, which was founded, after all, on an agreement to exchange British dominance in Egypt for French dominance in Morocco. The accession of Sir Edward Grey to the office of Foreign Secretary in December 1905 consolidated the influence of an emergent anti-German faction within the British Foreign Office. Grey's associates and subordinates supplied him with a steady stream of memos and minutes warning of the threat posed by Berlin. Dissenting voices within the Foreign Office were marginalized. Dispatches from British envoys in Germany that went against the grain of the dominant view, like those filed by Lassalle, de Salis, and Goschen in Berlin, were plastered with sceptical marginalia when they reached London. By contrast, the reports of Sir Fairfax Cartwright in Munich and later Vienna, which never failed to put the maximum negative spin on contemporary developments in Germany and Austria, were welcomed with accolades. An excellent and valuable report in all respects. Most interesting and well worth reading. An interesting and suggestive dispatch. A most able dispatch. Mr. Cartwright is a shrewd observer. A thoughtful review of the situation. And so on. In the official mind of British foreign policy, the history of Anglo-German relations was reconceived as a black record of German provocations. The Foreign Office junior clerk G.S. Spicer came to believe that Germany had been pursuing a line consistently unfriendly to the interests of Great Britain since the days of Bismarck. Looking back in later years, Grey was inclined to view the two decades between 1884 and his installment in office as an era of fundamentally misguided concessions to an implacable foe. Vague and undefined schemes of Teutonic expansion were imputed to the German leadership. The Germans were accused of seeking to establish a dictatorship over the continent, of deliberately aiming at world predominance, of wanting, as Bertie put it in the practical language of an Eton boy, to push us into the water and steal our clothes. In November 1909, Sir Charles Harding described Germany as the only aggressive power in Europe. Repeated mantra-like at every possible opportunity in dispatches, letters, and departmental minutes, such assertions merged to form a new virtual reality, a way of making sense of the world. Why did these people become so hostile to Germany? Did the Germans behave worse than the other powers, bullying and pushing in situations where other powers found a more emollient and biddable modus operandi? It is difficult, of course, in an environment where subjective impressions counted for so much, and the norms of acceptable behavior were so variable, to determine exactly how provocative specific styles and initiatives were. Was the Kruger telegram more provocative than the boldly worded Grover Cleveland message sent by Washington at around the same time to discourage British incursions into Venezuela? Was the seizure of Key Chow more provocative than the American acquisition of the Canal Zone or the creation of a Russian protectorate over Mongolia? Was Germany's blundering pursuit of a diplomatic triumph at Agadir more provocative than the unilateral measures by which France broke with the Franco-German-Morocco agreement in 1911? See Chapter 4. Perhaps these are the wrong questions to ask. The Germanophobes were rarely very specific about their case against the Germans. They spoke in general terms of the vaunting ambition and bullying demeanor of Germany, the unpredictability of the Kaiser and the threat German military prowess posed to the European balance of power, but they were coy about identifying actual German offences against good international practice. The fullest account of British grievances can be found in a famous memorandum on the present state of British relations with France and Germany, composed by Eyre Crowe, then senior clerk in the Western Department at the Foreign Office, in January 1907. Crowe was one of the most extraordinary figures in the British foreign policy world. His father had worked for the British consular service, but his mother and his wife were both German, and Crowe himself, born in Leipzig, was 17 and not yet fluent in English when he first visited England to cram for the Foreign Office entrance exam. Throughout his life, he spoke English with what contemporaries described as a guttural accent. One subordinate recalled being dressed down with the words, "What you have written on this report is utter rot." The perception that Crowe, though admirably efficient and industrious in his handling of departmental business, remained irredeemably Germanic in style and attitude, ensured that he never ascended as far through the ranks of the service as his talent warranted. Despite, or perhaps in part because of these personal attributes, Crowe became one of Whitehall's most implacable opponents of a rapprochement with Germany. The memorandum of the 1st of January 1907 opened with a brief overview of the recent Moroccan crisis. Crowe endowed the narrative with the contours of a boy's own morality tale. The German bully had threatened France in the hope of nipping in the bud her young friendship with Britain. But the bully had underestimated the pluck and loyalty of France's British pal. He miscalculated the strength of British feeling and the character of His Majesty's ministers. Like most bullies, this one was a coward, and the prospect of an Anglo-French coalition in arms was enough to see him off. But before he retreated, the bully further disgraced himself by crudely currying favour with the British friend, painting in attractive colours a policy of cooperation with Germany. How ought Britain to respond to this unlovely posturing? As the preeminent world power, Crowe argued, Britain was bound by what amounted to a law of nature to resist any state that aspired to establish a coalition opposed to British hegemony. Yet this was exactly what German policy intended to do. Germany's ultimate objective was German hegemony, at first in Europe and eventually in the world. But whereas British hegemony was welcomed and enjoyed by all and envied and feared by none on account of its political liberality and the freedom of its commerce, the vociferations of the Kaiser and the pan-German press showed that German hegemony would amount to a political dictatorship that would be the wreckage of the liberties of Europe. Of course, Crowe could not and did not object in principle to the growth in German power and influence. The problem lay in the abrasive and provocative way in which Germany pursued its objectives. But of what exactly did Germany's provocations consist? They included such enormities as dubious proceedings in Zanzibar, and the seizure of the Cameroons at a time when London had already announced its intention to grant the inhabitants of that country a British protectorate. Everywhere they looked, or so it seemed to Crowe, the British found themselves stumbling over the Germans. The list of outrages continued, from German financial support for the Transvaal Republic to complaints at London's conduct of the South African War, to vexatious meddling in the Yangtze Valley region, then considered to be practically a British preserve. And, to make matters worse, there was the somewhat unsavoury business of German efforts to influence the international press, from New York to St. Petersburg, Vienna, Madrid, Lisbon, Rome, Cairo, and even London, where the German embassy entertains confidential and largely unsuspected relations with a number of respectable and widely read papers. There is much one could say about this fascinating document, which Gray circulated as recommended reading to Prime Minister Sir Henry Campbell Bannerman and other senior ministers. First, there is Crowe's almost comical tendency to view the wars, protectorates, occupations, and annexations of Imperial Britain as a natural and desirable state of affairs, and the comparatively ineffectual manoeuvres of the Germans as gratuitous and outrageous breaches of the peace. How impossible of the Germans to pester Britain on the Samoa question when London was on the point of submitting its quarrel with the Transvaal to the arbitrament of war. Then there was the tendency to see the long arm of German policy behind every inter-imperial conflict. Thus, it was the Germans who fomented Britain's troubles with Russia in Central Asia and carefully encouraged the European opposition to Britain's occupation of Egypt. Wherever there was friction between Britain and its imperial rivals, the Germans were supposedly pulling strings in the background. As for German press manipulations from Cairo to London, there was more than a pinch of paranoia in Crowe's handling of this issue. German press work paled into insignificance beside the much larger and better financed subsidy operations run by St. Petersburg and Paris. Perhaps the offensive incidents were ultimately of secondary importance. The core of the argument was Crowe's nightmarish psychodrama of the German nation-state, imagined as a composite person conniving to gain concessions by offensive bluster and persistent nagging, a professional blackmailer, bullying and offending at every turn, manifesting a heedless disregard of the susceptibilities of other people. Whether there was any underlying plan behind all the bluster, or whether it was no more than the expression of a vague, confused, and unpractical statesmanship, not fully realizing its own drift, made little difference. The upshot was the same. Only the firmest discipline would teach the Germans good behavior. The French, too, Crowe recalled, had once been very annoying, gratuitously challenging Britain at every turn. But Britain's adamant refusal to yield an inch of ground on Egypt and the Sudan, followed by the threat of war over Fashoda, had put an end to all that. Now Britain and France were the best of friends. It followed that only the most unbending determination to uphold British rights and interests in every part of the globe would win the respect of the German government and the German nation. This was not a scenario that left much room to accommodate the rising power of Europe's youngest empire. Lurking beneath these apprehensions, though only indirectly alluded to in Crowe's text, was the spectacle of Germany's titanic economic growth. In 1862, when Bismarck had become minister-president of Prussia, the manufacturing regions of the German states accounted, with 4.9%, for the fifth largest share of world industrial production. Britain, with 19.9%, was well ahead in first place. In 1880 to 1900, Germany rose to third place, behind the United States and Britain. By 1913, it was behind the United States, but ahead of Britain. In other words, during the years 1860 to 1913, the German share of world industrial production increased fourfold, while the British sank by a third. Even more impressive was Germany's expanding share of world trade. In 1880, Britain controlled 22.4% of world trade. The Germans, though in second place, were well behind with 10.3%. By 1913, however, Germany, with 12.3%, was hard on the heels of Britain, whose share had shrunk to 14.2%. Everywhere one looked, one saw the contours of an economic miracle. Between 1895 and 1913, German industrial output shot up by 150%, metal production by 300%, coal production by 200%. By 1913, the German economy generated and consumed 20% more electricity than Britain, France, and Italy combined. In Britain, the words "made in Germany" came to carry strong connotations of threat, not because German commercial or industrial practice was more aggressive or expansionist than anyone else's, but because they hinted at the limits of British global dominance. German economic power underscored the political anxieties of the great power executives, just as Chinese economic power does today. Yet there was nothing inevitable about the ascendancy of Germanophobe attitudes in British foreign policy. They were not universal, even within the upper reaches of the Foreign Office itself, and they were even less prevalent across the rest of the political elite. Hard work behind the scenes was needed to lever Bertie, Nicholson, and Harding into the senior posts from which they were able to shape the tone and course of British policy. Bertie owed his rapid ascent after years of frustration in low-level positions to his energetic politicking with the private secretary to King Edward VII. Harding, too, was a seasoned courtier and intriguer who pushed Bertie's candidacy for the Paris ambassadorship in 1905. Harding employed his connections at court to override a certain amount of obstruction at the top of the FO. Bertie and Harding in turn cooperated in levering Arthur Nicholson into senior ambassadorial posts, despite the fact that his wife was said to shun society and to dress like a housemaid. British policy could have taken a different course. Had Grey and his associates failed to secure so many influential posts, less intransigent voices, such as those of Groschen and Lassalle, or of the Parliamentary Under-Secretary Edmund Fitzmaurice, who deplored the anti-German virus afflicting his colleagues, might have found a wider hearing. Instead, the Grey Group gradually tightened their grip on British policy, setting the terms under which relations with Germany were viewed and understood. The invention, as Keith Wilson has put it, of Germany as the key threat to Britain reflected and consolidated a broader structural shift. The polycentric world of the Great Games in Africa, China, Persia, Tibet, and Afghanistan, a world in which policymakers often felt they were lurching from crisis to crisis and reacting to remote challenges rather than setting the agenda, was making way for a simpler cosmos in which one enemy dominated the scene. This was not the cause of Britain's alignment with Russia and France, but rather its consequence. For the restructuring of the alliance system facilitated, indeed it necessitated, the refocusing of British anxieties and paranoia, which were riding high in the years around the Boer War. British foreign policy, like American foreign policy in the 20th century, had always depended on scenarios of threat and invasion as focusing devices. In the mid-19th century, French invasion scares had periodically galvanized the political elites. By the 1890s, France had been displaced in the British political and public imagination by Russia, whose Cossack hordes would soon be invading India and Essex. Now it was Germany's turn. The target was new, but the mechanisms were familiar. In retrospect, it is tempting to discern in the upheavals of 1904-7 the birth of the Triple Entente that would wage war in 1914. That was certainly how it looked to the French diplomat Maurice Paléologue, who published his diaries of these years 3 decades later under the title A Great Turning Point. Recomposed to incorporate the wisdom of hindsight, Paléologue's diaries endowed French policymakers, and especially Paléologue himself, with an almost supernatural foreknowledge of the war to come. In this respect, they exemplify a distortion of perception that is common to the post-war memoirs of many pre-war statesmen. The immense denouement of 1914 seems to us to command the horizons of the preceding decade. Yet the reality is that it does so only in our eyes, which is to say, in retrospect. It was still far from clear in 1907 that the new alliances would take Europe to war. The weakness of Russia after the disaster of 1905 obliged the policymakers in St. Petersburg in the first instance to seek good relations with Germany, and it was widely accepted in St. Petersburg, for the time being at least, that Russia's domestic fragility ruled out any form of international adventurism. It was hard to imagine the circumstances in which France might be willing to chance its arm for the Russians in the Balkans, and even harder to imagine Russians marching to Berlin for the sake of Alsace and Lorraine. In 1909, Paris underscored its independence by signing an accord on Morocco with Germany, a striking instance of the crossing of lines between the alliance blocs. Then, in November 1910, Russian and German leaders met in Potsdam and Berlin to reconcile German and Russian interests in Turkey and Persia. There was no question of loosening the Franco-Russian bond, to be sure, but this was a significant gesture in the direction of détente. As for the Anglo-Russian Convention of 1907, it may have muted the tensions between Russia and Britain, but it did not remove their cause, and right through until 1914, there were voices in the Foreign Office warning of the Russian threat to Britain's far-flung empire. In short, the future was not foreordained. The Triple Entente that went to war in 1914 still lay beyond the mental horizons of most statesmen. The great turning point of 1904-7 helps to explain the emergence of the structures within which a continental war became possible. But it cannot explain the specific reasons why that conflict arose. In order to do that, we need to examine how decision-making processes shaped policy outcomes, and how the loose network of the continental alliances became interlocked with conflicts unfolding on the Balkan Peninsula.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.